Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us today, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Jeremy Pelzer. Welcome back.
Hi.
And Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And also Public Affairs Reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Kathy Kandinsky. Welcome.
Good morning.
Governor Mike DeWine says he wants to close the loopholes that benefit pharmacy middlemen, pharmacy benefit managers is what they're technically called, such as CVS, Caremark, and Optum Rx. The State Department of Medicaid has ordered the contracts to be rewritten, but that's going to take time, right, Kathy?
That'll take probably a year or so, yes. These are big contracts. Ohio right now has five Medicaid managed care plans that in 2018 collected $15.4 billion in revenue.
So billion with a B.
It's probably the biggest expense the state pays out every year in terms of services. And so these are going to take a while, and I'm sure there'll be fierce competition. Last time we had, I think, seven companies compete for these contracts, so I expect there'd be more than the five that currently hold them.
So as long as they have the current contract, how they process and how they determine the pricing and that kind of thing is going to stay the same.
It changed last January 1st. It changed to a pass-through model, which is the pharmacy benefit managers are supposed to pay the pharmacies the exact same amount to fill the prescription as they bill the state. That was not happening, and there was a difference, and the pharmacy benefit managers were keeping that difference. It was about over $200 million in 1 year's time. So the state's trying to eliminate that price spread by going to a pass-through model that'll be more transparent, and the pharmacy benefit managers will just get a fee to provide the service.
Some pharmacy or pharmaceutical companies are posting their prices publicly now.
Right.
What's that about?
Well, that's I think President Trump actually brought that up about a year ago, and the idea is to bring more transparency of cost. So having them list the price on their commercials and advertisements and such. The problem is that often it's the list price, and people don't often that isn't actually the cost you end up paying often.
Mm-hmm. Out of pocket.
Correct.
Hmm. And then also, you said it's going to take about a year. Is that a typical length of time for this process?
I think they're basing it on what it took the last time. Okay. Last time it took a little over a year, and then there was a lawsuit. As you might imagine, they changed the score. They decided to go back and rechange the scoring, which made two people that thought they were getting the contracts no longer get the contracts, mm-hmm. which, as you might imagine, prompted a lawsuit.
And also, we've got the DeWine administration nose to the grindstone on this issue. But what about the Ohio General Assembly? Are they interested in this issue?
I think they've been long interested. I think JMOC, the Joint Medicaid Oversight Commission, was the one that kind of pushed the Department of Medicaid to kind of start addressing the problem last year. Medicaid was kind of sweeping it under the rug. They were satisfied with the prices they were paying. JMOC thought they could get a better deal, and DeWine thinks they can do even better than that. So I think the whole idea DeWine's coming at it from is we got to get a good contract. We're probably getting screwed because we have a bad contract, so he wants to tighten the contract.
One of those aspects of the contract is opaqueness.
Correct.
You don't know how they're setting their prices.
Nobody knows. One of the things in our reporting that I found so crazy was that the state knows how much they pay the managed care companies for pharmaceuticals, but they had no idea how much the PBMs were paying the pharmacists until the independent pharmacies came forward and say, hey, we're getting screwed here.
Which was what triggered your reporting.
Which is what
on this.
Triggered our reporting.
And
exactly.
Is there going to be something in the contract that changes that?
We'll have to see what the contract provisions are, but I'm sure it's going to be a lot more transparent. And I think they're going to go to everyone I talk to, the experts say a fee-based service is best rather than a spread price system. So pay the pharmacy benefit managers. So if you're going to employ pharmacy benefit managers, pay them a set fee per transaction rather than letting them keep rebates and all kinds of other revenues that you may or may not even be aware are coming in.
And I think where the legislature's role in this is to keep the pressure on the administration to make sure that's the direction it goes. I think, you know, after the Dispatch's reporting last spring, you actually heard legislators saying, like, wait a minute here, maybe we aren't getting the best deal and we really should make sure that we are. And I think, you know, the timing of it with the new governor coming in, this was all these managed care contracts were under Governor Kasich, and it's been a number of years. So it's probably just in the sense of things to you know, after we've done this, done it this way for a little bit, to stop and see, is there, what else is out there? Who else is out there? And things have changed since, you know, this was initiated. So it's a good time to, it makes sense to do this look again. But of course, it makes the managed care companies and PBMs a little nervous. And that's a big industry. You know, managed care is a big industry in Ohio.
Right. How are the managed care companies and the PBMs responding to this scrutiny?
With a happy face.
Yeah.
They're saying they welcome the new contracts. They're going to work with the state, and they point out every chance they get how much money they're saving the state, which I had someone explain it to me like this. If you see a car advertised for $100,000 and somebody says, I'm going to give it to you for $50,000, you think you're getting a great deal, but then you go down the street and somebody offers it to you for $30,000, better deal. The car only costs $10,000. It's kind of what's happening here.
Right.
There's a lot more savings to be had.
That's why I only ever buy from the 75% off rack. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard from Kathy Kandisky, public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, about the reporting that started last, well, it didn't start last spring, but their first story started coming out in last spring about pharmacy benefit managers. And of course, we'll be talking about that more as the issue evolves. Also with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Inquirer and Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Okay, so let's talk about those particular campaign funds that are left over when a campaign goes dormant, at least. In particular, you know, former political campaign candidates such as Connie Pillich, who's got a bundle stashed away. Jackie Borchardt, what about that? She's golden?
Golden. I mean, it definitely puts her in an interesting position because she's not, you know, currently running for anything right now. And she can give that money to other candidates.
There's no restrictions.
Causes and campaigns. And, you know, we see this every election cycle where, you know, money kind of goes through different channels. It may get a large sum, maybe donated to the state party, for example, and then the state party supports its various candidates. And but it is interesting to have, you know, Connie Pilch did a good job of, she was in the governor's race for, I think, about a year. And, you know, clearly was able to raise money to be somewhat competitive in what was a big field at the time. So it is interesting when people end with this kind of money, and she's still very much, you know, she has a political future as well. I mean, she, I think, is still someone who could reemerge on the statewide level, or, you know, at least on the regional level in Southwest Ohio.
But, you know, Jeremy Pelzer, part of building that future is doling out favors, right?
Yeah, money is the best way to keep yourself relevant and to make people like you, especially if someone else is running for office. But they can use it for other things as well. For example, there's a former Supreme Court Justice, Paul Pfeiffer. And, for example, he hasn't run for office in a long time, but he spent something like $9,000 on an official portrait of himself. So they can... you can spend it on things other than spreading favors to other people. Because I don't think, you know, Paul Pfeiffer's not going to run for anything. So there's many things you can do with this money. The only thing you can't do, though, it's illegal to spend it on stuff for technically yourself. Like, you can't buy a new boat with something.
Or pay your mortgage.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can, but it's illegal.
Are there a lot? I mean, are there others like Connie Pillich? But she was a pretty good fundraiser. That was one of the things she had going for.
Surprisingly good.
Yeah. Yeah. Any others like her out there?
Well,
Well, usually they're committee chairmen or something like that, that amass a little bit more than typical.
There's all these Democratic statewide candidates that were able to raise a lot of money, in not just last year, but in 2014. And, you know, just because it's a statewide office and you're going to have, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars left over when all is said and done. One other person is John Carney. He ran for state auditor 2014. He's been just giving out little donations here and there to charities and to various, you know, Democratic Party things. You know, so everyone has a different way of doing it, especially because, again, you can kind of tell. The big thing of this is you can tell who's going to run again and who is kind of
by how they spend
cashed
their money.
Out. Yeah, by how they're spending their money.
Huh.
And Connie Pillage, for example, is kind of saying, well, I'm going to keep my powder dry until this fall when there's a bunch of mayor's races and then make a decision then.
I like that Connie Pillage, she like put her money in a savings account or a CD account. So it was kind of like, all right, well, it's going to be, you know, I don't want to touch this for a while. So she, you know, kind of did a responsible thing and it's earning interest. But I guess that's to be expected maybe of a former candidate for state treasurer.
You think she's looking at something like mayor?
You know, I don't know. I haven't talked to her. You know, Southwest Ohio politics are interesting. Hamilton County is becoming a much more Democratic area.
Yeah.
Now all of the county commissioners down there are Democrats. And, you know, with redistricting coming up, you know, that part of the state will change as well as far as congressional districts go. So I don't know. I think, you know, I don't think her career is over. I think, you know, there's still some open doors there. So I think it's smart of her to, you know, I kind of, you know, when I read Jim Siegel's story last week about this, I instantly thought of like someone who wins the lottery. And then everyone, you know, when they find out that someone won the lottery, you know, you hear from like all these relatives that you haven't talked to in years and neighbors and, you know, everyone's trying to get friendly with you. And to just, I think it's smart to just say, you know, look, I'm just going to go hands off on this for a while.
You've written about, there's two pieces of legislation that have been introduced in the House that would address tax exemptions for certain products or add them to a list of products that include prescription drugs, medical devices, that kind of a thing. Jackie, you've written about the legislation. This is not the first time it's been introduced to exempt tampons, or I should say menstrual products in general. And then there's also another bill to exempt diapers.
Yeah, so the so-called tampon tax, which would remove sales tax on all menstrual products. So that's pads, tampons, cups, I mean, all those different things. This is the third General Assembly it's been introduced. Last year, it actually passed the House. It was amended. It was folded into another bill, and it almost unanimously passed the House. But because it was put into another bill, it did not get through the Senate. And there was some discussion that it was because there were some concerns about the other part of the legislation, and it just basically ran out of time. So this year, it's being reintroduced, and it has a Republican joint sponsor, and that's Republican Representative Niraj Antani from Miamisburg. And he, toward the end of last session, introduced a similar bill to remove sales tax on diapers. And that was kind of too late again to go through. So basically, he and Democrat Bridget Kelly teamed up to jointly sponsor each other's bills with the idea that, you know, with a Republican and a Democrat on it, hopefully we can, mm-hmm. you know, get this done. And so the diaper tax one would be right now in Ohio revised code, diapers are considered clothing. And so that's where the sales tax comes from. And so this would make sure that disposable diapers as well as washable diapers would be exempt from that. And diapers cost a lot of money. If
yeah.
you're I know it's been a while for you, Ann, but
no, I prance by the aisle like happy as a lark.
Right. So, you know, the Ohio sales tax rate is 5.75%. Depending on where you live, that can go up to 8%.
And that brings me a question. Does this affect local taxes
yes.
as well or just
yes.
state tax?
Okay. Yeah. So the tampon tax.
So it's going to cost local entities.
It would. Yeah, it would cost local entities a little bit. I think the Legislative Service Commission last year estimated about $4.5 million total impact from the tampon tax. And that would include they're factoring into that local government funding that would have been in there. But that doesn't get to the local impact for, you know, local sales taxes that are added on to that. The University of Cincinnati estimated that to be almost twice as much. So it's kind of it's not really known. They're estimating based on saying, hey, this is Ohio's female population between these ages. And this is kind of our guess.
You know, I think you wrote this, but you mentioned Representative Antani from Miamisburg, and he had said that when the tampon tax was introduced 4 years ago, he thought it was a stunt. What was he talking about? What changed his mind?
Yeah, I mean, it was brought by two Democratic women, and he thought that it was like a very smart political stunt to make a point that, you know, Republicans don't care about women or there's a war on women. And if they really are anti-tax, they would be, you know, against these types of taxes that are levied on products that women need. They're not an option. Right. And so that was kind of his initial impression. And then as he learned more about it, you know, he's a self-ascribed fiscal conservative, doesn't like taxes, realized that this is an unfair tax. And it's really as part of an equalizing measure, it should not be taxed. They're medically necessary. And it makes sense for women and families to, you know, give any part of their money, let them keep as much of it as possible.
We are going to continue our conversation. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Jackie Borchardt, Columbus Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Also with us, Jeremy Pelzer of thecleveland.com and Kathy Kandisky from the Columbus Dispatch. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. State income tax revenue is down. Any particular, Jeremy Pelzer, what do we know about that?
It's down for the past 2 months. It was up the 5 months before that.
But the past 2 months, that's kind of surprising given the holidays, right?
Well, some of it has to do with the new federal tax deal. And, you know, people want to pay off their income tax, you know, before the end of the year. And, you know, there's a lot of different reasons that people don't pay income tax during the first couple of months of the year. Sometimes they defer it, that kind of thing. You know, you have to look at it not just in terms of 1 or 2 months. You have to look at it in terms of the whole year. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit down for the whole year, but it's not like the sky is falling because, again, it was up the 5 months before. So, you know, there's a lot of different reasons. And some of these reasons we won't even know until like April or May.
Well, does it affect much, Kathy Kandisky?
It could. You know, we're getting into the budget negotiations here. And so it could affect what, you know, Governor DeWine's going to propose his first 2-year state budget. I think it's due out by March 15th. And his administration will be looking very closely at those budget revenues as they put together their plan. So it does have an impact. But Jeremy's absolutely correct. I mean, 2 months is not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Wait and see what it is at the end of, you know, the year, a couple more months. If it keeps trending down, then there's reason for concern.
It portends something more serious.
Right. And I think over those 2 months, it's something like $120 million, which, you know, we have a $70 billion
plus. Is it $70 billion? Okay.
I think we're there. Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, if it continues to go down, then that's, you know, bad news for, you know, the DeWine administration. This is their first budget. Obviously, there are things that he wants to do, things that he promised on the campaign trail he wants to do. And so that just makes it a little bit more difficult to find money for some of these initiatives. And he didn't, you know, he was very careful, I think, while campaigning to not promise a lot of new money, knowing Ohio's past couple years of budgeting. And but he did, you know, promise more for early childhood programs, for, you know, mental health support for children, those types of things, which, you know, do cost money.
Any of this have anything to do with the federal tax changes?
Yeah.
Yes.
The new state budget director, Kim Erniex, she said we won't know definitively until like April when they issue more numbers. But on kind of the first glance, before this tax law, you could claim a higher dollar amount of exemptions. And So people, there was an incentive, especially in 2017, which was the last tax year, to, you know, make those tax payments in December or before the end of the year so that you could still get that deduction. And now that 2018 will be the first year under the new tax law and it's much lower. And so there's really not an incentive for people to make those last minute or, you know, end of the year payments.
Okay, which is what you were talking about.
Yeah, last year was even more screwy because of the new federal tax law. Like people just either deferred it or they more just paid it in December. So you saw these like huge shifts month to month about like, oh my gosh, like, you know, it's 60% above expectations. It's 40% below expectations, but it all kind of evens out. You know, so you shouldn't just look at 1 or 2 months because everyone's still paying their taxes. It's just a question of when they're paying their taxes.
That's a good point.
Are you guys hearing a lot of people talking about their tax bill this year?
Lately.
I think more people are starting. I personally didn't want to do them during the shutdown because I'm just like,
what's the point?
Whoa, IRS. No one's going to be able to help me there.
Hotline's closed.
But I have seen some, you know, anecdotally, some things where people are finally figuring out that they are not or they are benefiting from the tax law. And maybe, you know, they're surprised either way. Mainly, I'm seeing people who are more upset about the tax law because they were. Obviously, you hear from people who are more upset more often because they're going to gripe about things.
Right.
But, you know, people who live in parts of the country that have a high cost of living where they were able to, you know, their house costs a lot of money. They pay a lot in local and state taxes. But that's OK because they could write those all off for their federal taxes. And now they're much more limited in, I forget off the top of my head what the bar is, but they're much more limited in what they can write off. And now, so it will be, you know,
cost
no more.
You get an automatic $23,000, I mean, in that middle bracket.
Right. But in some of these high, you know, like I have a friend in New Jersey who, you know, she's right off the bat is like, well, we're going to be paying more because the numbers are just not working in our favor.
You needed to, if people didn't adjust their withholdings after the tax changes, those are people that are seeing lower returns or owing more.
Right. So call your tax hotline.
IRS is back open. So
yeah.
The IRS is open for business. You're listening to our weekly reporter roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking with Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. If you have a question or comment about state government politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown spent the weekend in New Hampshire on his Dignity of Work tour. He was in Iowa last week. He's been getting a lot of national attention and buzz. I mean, there's a lot. It's a busy field nonetheless, but he's getting some points. What is making him so attractive to the national media at this point, Kathy Kandisky?
Well, I think one of the things that's making him an attractive candidate is because he's from the Midwest. And this is an area of the country where Donald Trump did really well, surprisingly well, and a place where Democrats know they need to do better next time. So Brown's won races in Ohio for as long as we all can remember. So he's a strong candidate. A lot of people think he'll be able to connect with workers across the Midwest Rust Belt states. I think that's the initial interest in him.
In Iowa, he stuck to the outer belt, outside the beltway kind of a thing, smaller towns. Did he do the same thing in New Hampshire, Jeremy Pelzer?
Well, it's all small towns in New Hampshire, basically. But I mean, yeah, he's one of the reasons the media narrative on him is he's sort of the Trump voter whisperer, you know, from a manufacturing state, and he can win over these blue collar white male voters that voted for Obama but then voted for Trump. But that could be a trap for him, and he realizes that because if the media narrative is he's this, you know, he only appeals to these manufacturing, you know, voters, that you'll have all these liberal activists and, more importantly, liberal donors who will say, oh, OK, he's sort of like the centrist candidate. And, you know, he has to make sure that he's appealing to their votes as well, because, you know, and if the media narrative is just that he's this, oh, he's a Trump with a D after his name, then he has to make sure that he can win them. And that's why you're seeing like a Nan Whaley pen like that op-ed in the Des Moines Register being like, hey, you know, he's not just about, you know, working class people. He's about all these other groups, too. And so I think he's trying to make sure that he doesn't get boxed in like that.
It's interesting to hear Sherrod Brown mentioned as a moderate in the Democratic field.
It reminds me
of, like, you know, John Kasich was the moderate in the presidential field, and everyone in Ohio was like, no, he's not. And, you know, like, Sherrod Brown has a very liberal record. You know, as someone who's been in office, he has decades of voting records and positions that anybody can go back to, and that's, you know, for good or bad. But, you know, he on some of these kind of, if you had a checklist of things that, you know, liberal and progressive Democrats want, I mean, he checks a lot of those boxes. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the early issue that's emerged on the Democratic primary, pre-primary, whatever you want to call it, is this idea of Medicare for all.
Yeah.
Because you've got, you know, the far, I think, left wing of the party really pushing it hard and almost as an ultimatum, like if that candidate's not for Medicare for all, then, you know, we shouldn't even bother with them. And so, you know,
and he's not,
but he's in favor of getting there someday. That's kind of the answer that he's, because this has come up in Iowa, and that's what this, you know, listening tour is good for, because he's actually getting these kinds of questions. And, you know, the way that he has explained this in the last couple of weeks is, you know, he's for getting people at 55 or 50 to buy in. And then once we see that that works and the sky's not falling, then, you know, let's talk about it some more. But I think it'll be interesting to see what that effect of that far left wing has. Like, you know, we saw this in 2016 with Bernie Sanders, and, you know, Bernie Sanders got Hillary Clinton to go, you know, more left on several things. So I'll be interested to see in the coming months what pull that actually has, because, you know, for all this talk of, you know, will he get the liberals and being a moderate, in New Hampshire this weekend, my colleague Scott Wortman was with Brown, and, you know, he talked to a lot of voters there who see Brown as more moderate compared to some of these other candidates, and they like that. They think that appeals to them because they see that as a winning quality, as a, you know, general election winning quality.
Mm-hmm. His Medicare buy-in proposal really speaks to the concern that people have with the Medicare for all idea, is how you're going to pay for it. Nobody's put a price on it, but we know it's going to be a bazillion dollars. Mm-hmm. His proposal is more workable the way he's proposing to do it. Have people buy in when they're 50 or 55 years old and older.
Ex-lawmaker Gene Krebs was on Columbus on the Record, and he had a really good point, which was don't look at what Sherrod Brown's doing publicly. Look at the other hand. And what I mean by that is, so yeah, he's going to Iowa, New Hampshire, et cetera. But look at the big thing now is money. He needs money to be a viable candidate. So while, yeah, he's going to Iowa, New Hampshire, talking to voters, look at look to see if he's going to New York or San Francisco.
Look at his phone bills.
Look at to see if he's holding these fundraisers that gives him the money.
Because those are the coastal money.
That's where
the important
Democratic money is, and he needs that money if he's going to be a viable candidate. Hmm.
Is he pretty good at raising money generally, or what do we know about his – I mean, he – you know, it's never – well, he did fine in the last couple races he ran for U.S. Senate.
Yeah, 2012 was the most expensive Senate race ever in Ohio history, and he outraised Josh Mandel, who's a pretty good fundraiser himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at just 2018. You know, he was running against someone who had considerably less money than him, less well known, and he still raised, you know, more than $24 million. Yeah. So, you know, yes, he can. And that is always the question about the money. And when you have a big field, where does the money go? But I think, you know, that's something that is maybe the next step, or is happening, you know, concurrently, is reaching out to some of those donors and trying to, you know, figure that out.
Yeah, you know, everybody's jumping in.
Right. I mean, I don't think he can wait to start raising money.
But he's not yet.
Not yet. He's going to make a decision, I think, later in March.
He keeps telling people March. Mm.
That's pretty late.
Yeah, it is kind of late. Although he's kind of a quasi-candidate now. So, you know, he's getting the benefit of it as if he's running, because he's doing all these visits and stuff. He just hasn't announced.
It kind of reminds me of what John Kasich did back in the day with his
balanced budget tour.
Whatever happened to that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was exactly what it was, right?
We all drew blanks. So, what did happen to that?
That's exactly what it was, right? It was the precursor to the his campaign. It was testing the waters and testing his message of, you know, not just balancing the budget, but other things that he went on to campaign on in 2016.
I don't know of any candidate who's done something like this, like going to all early primary states and decided, nah.
Yeah.
No, I just wanted to talk about the dignity of work with regular, you know, Americans.
Well, it's funny because I think, you know, a couple of weeks ago, Senator Brown said, you know, I just want this message to be part of the discussion for 2020.
Right.
And like that would be success. Right.
Famous
so over
words.
The weekend, you know, Cory Booker, the New Jersey senator, actually did kind of start talking
yeah.
about dignity of work and we need to respect, the dignity of work. And so, you know, I saw that and laughed because, oh, mission accomplished. I guess he doesn't have to run. But there was a kind of a fun Twitter exchange between the two of them on that.
I think it's interesting that Sherrod Brown has attracted attention about his appearance and his voice. So, I mean, of all the candidates,
he stands out. It's a definite asset. You need to stand out in some way in people's minds that, you know, beyond your policy ideas. And no one would mistake when you are just listening in the background when Sherrod Brown comes on. It's
you know,
an
when
asset.
He got, when
him.
He got the haircut, everyone said he's running. And I posit that if he keeps getting the haircut, because he let it grow out again, people.
Yeah, get the mullet, try out different ones, yeah. The flock of seagulls hair.
Yeah, yeah. And it'll be interesting to see how long his voice holds out if he does decide to run.
Oh, yeah. You don't want Sherrod Brown with a hoarse voice.
Yeah. Like, can you imagine? We are going to continue our conversation. The Ohio General Assembly they got their committee assignments made. We're going to talk about that coming up. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to our weekly reporter roundtable on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, Jeremy Pelzer, public affairs reporter with the Columbus Dispatch, Kathy Kandisky, and Columbus bureau chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer, Jackie Borchardt. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ohio's medical marijuana registry is growing by leaps and bounds. As of last week on February 8th, almost 13,000 Ohioans had activated a registration. Was this growth expected? Is this all, you know, is the state managing it? Okay, Kathy Kandisky?
I think they anticipated that there'd be a couple hundred thousand people that would get medical marijuana cards. So 13,000 to start doesn't surprise me.
Okay.
I mean, it'll just keep building from there. I know of some people that have gotten their cards for different ailments that they have or chronic conditions, and they've just not expressed any concern about it, that it was fairly simple steps
right.
for them to get.
Ohio makes it pretty easy. My grandmother is looking at getting a card, and she lives in Illinois, and it seems they just did kind of what Ohio did to make it so that once you register, you immediately get your card, and then you're able to use it. The big problem right now in Ohio is that there are only a handful of dispensaries open, and there's one in Sandusky and the rest are in northeast Ohio or the eastern edge of the state. So that leaves out, you know, Columbus, Toledo, Cincinnati, southern Ohio without really a
And that's just 'cause the dispensaries
place.
Haven't opened up yet or
Yeah, I mean these are all private businesses. So the state issued the licenses in June. And then it was up to each of those businesses to build or renovate or, you know, and we've got varying structures, right? You've got some people who took like an old Burger King and they're renovating it. And then you've got some people who had to just do completely new construction. And then, you know, all the things that involve building a new business, like getting your building permit and, you know, having all the proper inspections, fire marshal, all of those things happen after the licenses were issued. And so that's why you see, I think, the two that opened in Wintersville, which is outside of Steubenville on the east, far eastern edge of the state. Wintersville was very accommodating to the industry. They don't have a lot of regulations on businesses there. So it was very, you know, the business owners there told me it was very easy for them to start where, you know, if you've got someone in Cleveland proper, you know, Columbus proper, Cincinnati proper, they're dealing with a lot more
control
regulation.
Issues, yeah. You know, I mean, some people are just going over the border to Michigan. They're accepting Ohio cards, too.
People have been going over the border for a long time, man.
Yeah. That's why I caution to say Toledo, because Toledo is practically in Michigan.
Yeah, it's exactly it. But is there any sense about what this is going to generate in terms of revenue for the state yet?
Well, I talked to the new Department of Commerce director last week, and she was saying by fall they anticipate that there'll be enough dispensaries open with licenses that they'll be able to actually pay for the medical marijuana program, because right now they're going on borrowed money from the state. Mm-hmm. So maybe Jackie or Kathy would know an exact thing, but it's they expect it to grow enough, at least for the program to be self-sustaining.
I think industry experts had said that with Ohio set of conditions, an estimated patient population of about 200,000, that Ohio's market would be about $400 million a year. Once it's fully operational, and that would be fully operational as all the licenses are handed out, they're mm-hmm. all open, and you have 200,000 patients registered.
And 200,000 is based on the current list of admissible conditions.
Right.
There's a lot of people think that those conditions are good. The number of conditions will expand.
I wouldn't be surprised if the number is actually significantly higher, because there's definitely, I mean, doctors are definitely not advertising in a sense, but letting their patients know this is available. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see that number increase.
Hmm. All right. So the Ohio General, well, the House kind of got down to business last week. Jeremy Pelzer, they announced committee assignments. What's the distinction here? And does this mean they're like nose to the grindstone?
So they're starting committee hearings this week. I just got an email in my inbox that they're starting on the transportation budget, which
is the first one to go.
Which is the first one to go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously that's important, especially now because of the potential gas tax increase. But they're expected to drop the heartbeat bill again, which is, of course, would limit abortion. It would ban abortions after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. So there's all kinds of stuff coming now that they have their committees up. And, yeah, they're going to hit the ground running.
It's been interesting what Larry Householder promised Democrats. Mm-hmm. He is giving them a lot more access than they've had to a voice on the committees in a long time.
Correct.
Kathy?
Well, he's put some Democrats in charge of a committee or two. He's
subcommittees,
put subcommittees.
That kind of thing, yeah.
He's put more Democrats on committees, so they have the higher numbers. They're still a minority, though. And he's also made some rule changes that will allow their amendments to come up for a vote, which they were very happy. But I would point out that all of these things are process-oriented. Whether they have any impact on policy has yet to be seen. And that will depend on how the Republicans come together. You know, it was a really brutal battle for the speaker's job. If they come back together now, they won't really need the Democrats. So we'll see how it goes. Mm. But Jeremy brought up the possibility of a gas tax. That is something they would definitely need Democratic votes for.
Mm-hmm. What's really interesting, too, with these committee assignments with the Democrats is there's a lot of freshmen, first-time lawmakers who voted for Larry Householder who got ranking member seats. You know, like people who have never served in the legislature before. That's unusual. And all these people voted for Householder and they're
for speaker. Yeah,
voted for speaker. And now it seems they're getting a payoff. Not that there was literally a payoff, but now they bet on the right horse.
Hmm. Their loyalty is being rewarded.
That's correct. Yeah.
What are the expectations for you made the point that they're on. I mean, what's going to be the litmus test that Democrats so far have, you know, bet on the right horse, but going forward, what does that need to look like to maintain their support?
Jackie? You know, I don't know. Like Kathy had mentioned, these are all things done on the process side. We haven't heard of any, like, policy promises, right? Like nothing like, oh, we're not going to introduce this bill or that bill or, you know, whatever. So I think if you see in a couple months from now that some of these process changes have led to more Democratic amendments being accepted into bills or bills that don't maybe have a Republican joint sponsor advancing or getting a couple more committee hearings than they typically do, that I think that's a win. I think some people could look at that and say, well, that's not really a win, right? Because the bill's not passing necessarily, or maybe the amendment's removed later, but it's more than what they had.
It's something to put on their campaign literature.
Right. Right. Well, you know, one of the rule changes was that you couldn't just automatically vote to table amendments. You have to actually discuss them first before you reject them. It mm-hmm. doesn't mean that they're going to all of a sudden accept some of these amendments offered by Democrats, but at least they would have the chance to make their case and talk about it. And they could very much just still reject them. But I think the hope is that if they have the opportunity to make their case and actually talk about some of these things, there's more of an opportunity for these bills to be more bipartisan.
The other thing I would add to that is they can make Republicans more accountable. A lot of times the Republicans table these amendments so they don't have to take a vote on them.
Right.
So they don't have to be on record as being a supportive or against a particular issue. Democrats can force them to go on record, which could be useful information for them come election time.
Right.
Notably, former Speaker Ryan Smith was not appointed to committee.
He got committee assignments.
He's not going to be leading any committee.
That's not surprising at all.
Yeah. But it makes me wonder how well the caucus will come together.
Well, a bunch of people got either in leadership
right.
or they got committee chairmanship.
So people who voted for Smith weren't punished for doing that?
Not necessarily. Like, for example, the majority floor leader is still Bill Sykes, who voted for Smith. And
Bill Sykes, you know. He's...
yeah, but Laura Linnese, you know, from Grove City, yeah. she's still in leadership. And you have people like Gary Scheer, all these people that your audience may or may not know. The point is a lot of Ryan Smith people did get rewarded. And I'm sure it's, after Householder reached out or these lawmakers reached out to Householder and said, hey, let's let bygones be bygones. You know, I'm willing to work with you.
Speaker Householder needs Ryan Smith's people. I mean, right. More Republicans voted for Ryan Smith than voted for Householder. So if he wants to keep his caucus together or unite his caucus, he's going to need to reach out to Ryan Smith supporters.
What else is coming up this week now that they're down to business? What are you guys looking at? You said heartbeat bill.
And the Senate's also going to announce their kind of top priorities. This started a couple years ago where each of the caucuses kind of have a press conference and say these are our top 10 bills or top, seven bills. And, we've had people say they're going to introduce bills, but we don't have any actual registered bills right now because mm-hmm. they're waiting for the leadership to roll out whatever these top 10 bills are. So I think from the Senate, we're going to see also this week, some sort of maybe just a placeholder at this time, but something for criminal justice reform, especially with drug sentencing. On the heels of the issue one campaign and eventual failure at the ballot box last mm-hmm. year, Senate President Larry Obhoff has taken a personal interest in continuing that discussion and actually doing something on that issue. And there's bipartisan support for that. So I think that's one of the big issues the Senate will want to tackle. And they've got a little bit of time to do this too before they get the budget over to them, where the House is going to be very focused on the budget.
Well, the transportation budget, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do have a little wiggle room because Mike DeWine, as a new governor, has a little bit more time to introduce.
Yeah, it's till March.
March 15th or Everything something.
Everything's
like
happening
that.
In March, Ann.
What can I say? I guess we'll just cancel the show until March. But what else, Kathy Kandisky?
The heartbeat bill is the one that I'm waiting on to see. Other than that, I'm not really sure what they're going to be coming up with outside the realms of the two budgets. I mean, that's going to take the bulk of their time.
Right.
Another bill you're probably going to see is they're going to reintroduce the ban on cities prohibiting plastic bags.
Yeah, what was that? I mean,
so so a number of cities, no cities in Ohio have passed a ban on plastic bags. Or not, I'm sorry, not a ban, a tax. I misspoke. So some cities like Cleveland Athens have proposed a tax on plastic bags. So like 10
the grocery
cents.
Bags
yeah,
you get,
just
yeah.
grocery bags. You go to the store and you have to pay an extra 10 cents for every bag you use. And a number of lawmakers, a couple Republicans who have bag manufacturers in their districts, introduced legislation last year that would prohibit cities from imposing taxes on plastic bags. They didn't get it passed last year, and they say they're going to introduce it first thing this year.
It's kind of interesting that the Republicans are going after a local issue like that. I mean, it used to be, I mean, maybe I've been around too long, I don't know, that the Republicans didn't like to stomp on local control.
Well, the local control has been under attack for probably a good 10 years now with
right.
the ban, you know, local bans on
guns
in right. parks and public places. They put the kibosh, the state lawmakers right. put the kibosh on that. There's other examples as well.
They last General Assembly prevented cities from setting a minimum wage that's
right.
higher than the state's. I mean, there's been a number of measures, and it comes back to whenever these things come up, the Republicans say, well, we are for local control unless it's an issue that's going to have a statewide business impact. And we saw this also with the Petland bill that, you know, was trying to get block Grove City's effort to you know,
right.
keep puppy
That's
mill
right.
dogs out of pet stores. And, you know, their argument there was, look, it's not just Grove City. This type of decision could affect business statewide.
And local officials, you know, are still reeling from the loss of local state tax revenues that they've gotten in years past that have dried up.
Right.
I think DeWine delivered the message to them not too long ago that that money is not coming back. So they'll have a good argument to push back on this tax issue.
Mm-hmm. There are other issues before the Ohio General Assembly that they're going to revisit now that Mike DeWine's there. I mean, I know that the heartbeat bill is something he has said he would sign off on. He would sign it into law, and they're probably – you know, going to go that, you know, it's expected to come on. But anything else that Kasich wasn't interested in looking into that the DeWine administration is more interested in?
Well, again, you have all these DeWine set up all these advisory boards to make recommendations on things like home visitation for at-risk mothers, early childhood education, that sort of thing. And they're going to make it's kind of fast tracked. So by like the end of the month, they're going to make the recommendations, and it's going to be specifically recommendations that involve more money. So
I think that, you know, there are a couple things that Governor Kasich tried to do or tried to accomplish that didn't get done, that now with a new administration, the legislature feels like maybe they are able to do something on. I think kind of the big issues there are like the Lake Erie water quality stuff, which Kasich tried to kind of ram through on his way out of office. And there have been discussions from interested, you know, all the different parties there on how to move forward on that. And that's something that maybe now that we have a fresh administration, you'll be able to get people together on. The unemployment compensation insurance issue still lingers. And that's kind of a question mark of, you know, is this now the year where that will happen?
No.
Just in time for the next recession.
There's no sign.
Well, particularly with the budget. I mean, the budget would be the logical vehicle,
right.
wouldn't it? And
there's no sign so far that.
That's going to require an increase in the tax on businesses that businesses pay into the unemployment comp system.
What?
Well, it's cutting benefits.
Both.
Cutting
benefits. Yeah. They're going to have to cut benefits.
It's going to have to be yeah.
But in this legislature, the more important part for them to consider is increasing the business tax, which is something that I just would be surprised that they've been unable to do it thus far. I'm not sure that there's been enough change.
Hmm. Yeah, I think the other two big issues looming is Medicaid expansion and how the state might be able to rein that in. And, of course, with a new governor, school funding is always
top
of mind.
Oh, yeah. There's always school funding. Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Inquirer, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, you as well.
Thank you.
And Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much, Ann.
Thanks for to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.